And good evening. It's 7 o'clock on 2SCR. That means it's Panacea on Tuesday night, your health program coming out every Tuesday night. Tonight we'll be talking about eating disorders, how we can use ant venom, also embryo adoption, and finally, linking lungs with asthma problems. So lots to stay tuned for the next half hour.
2SER 107.3 FM and now digital.
You might be familiar with a spider venom and its uses, and an anti-venom for a dangerous spider bite or its use in certain pharmaceuticals such as those for chronic pain. What about ant venom? I know I was bitten last weekend by an enormous bull ant. A group of researchers from the University of Technology, Sydney, are researching the use of ant venom to form a bioinsecticide. The insecticide would help tackle global issues of food security without relying on synthetic and chemical-based pesticides that food agricultural fields today. This is Samir Ali, PhD candidate for the University of Technology, talking about the research.
Well, because our population is increasing massively, and at this rate, there's not enough food to supply the people. The added fact is that, as you know, there's massive hunger problems in the world, there's famines being declared, and we're still not being able to increase our food supply. We're not going to increase our land, so one way to attack the problem is to attack the insects. That way we at least increase our crops by 20%, which is right now almost what the insects are causing in terms of destruction to the crops.
Worldwide?
Worldwide, yeah.
Right. Insert ant venom. You were just talking about a spider venom being commercialised as a bioinsecticide.
Yeah.
I actually have a question first. How do you get the ant venom?
Yeah, that's the most common question I get. So the abdomen is the backside of the ant, and it's not, when you get bitten by an ant, it's not actually them biting you, it's them inserting their stinger, which is located at the back end. So the venom gland is just above there. They have a stinger like bees. We remove the whole stinger with the venom gland attached. So we take the glands from hundreds of them and then get the venom out that way.
What type of ant?
So most of my ants are actually from South America, and they're sent by our collaborators over there. You might have heard of the bullet ant, Paraponera clavata. That one's inflicts the most painful insect sting known to man. And
wow, really?
Yeah, so on a scale of 1 to 7 by the person who's created this scale, number 7 is the bullet ant. It actually has pain that lasts for over 2 days.
Why is it so painful?
That's what we're trying to figure out. They associate the pain to one particular peptide, which is the neurotoxic one.
What's a peptide?
A peptide is a small protein, but then there's a whole lot of other things in the venom as well that would cause the pain.
Is it literally going out into an area and just getting some ants?
Yep. So most of my ants are actually from South America, in French Guiana in South America. So my collaborator Axel Tushar is actually the one who's responsible for dissecting all the ants, which is great. He just goes out into the forest, as he says, I'm just going to the forest this weekend and I'll collect some ants for you. Yeah, just got an email this weekend like that. We went up to the Blue Mountains once with him. He came over and we literally just walk around, look under rocks until you find, because they usually live in colonies, so you find a whole lot of them, put them into a bag and bring them back home.
Why have we historically looked at spiders first and used their venom as opposed to ants, when it seems that if they do bunch in colonies, there are much more of them and it seemed to be a more suitable option in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, when you think venoms, you think spiders, you think snakes, you think all these ones. And ants are usually the last thing you think of as having a venom to look at. Also, the fact that historically the instruments available to analyse venoms are not as advanced as they are now, so it was difficult to want to analyse small amounts of material, which was the case with ants. Whereas spiders, you get a lot more venom from them, and usually you can get, it's a renewable resource. You take it once, leave them for a few weeks, and then you can get the venom, milk the venom again.
They develop it back.
Whereas with ants, what we've been doing is actually dissecting the whole venom gland out, which means the ant obviously is dead now and you can't use the venom again. But we've actually been looking at electrical stimulation as a form to get the venom out of the ant, and that has worked. And we found that it is similar to dissected venom as well.
Right, so you expose them to like an electric current or something?
Yeah, exactly that. So,
do they have to die because of that?
No, they don't. So that's why we're looking at that as an option as well.
So you have the ant venom and you're putting it into something to form this bioinsecticide. Are you mixing it with other things, or is it literally just the venom itself that you would be using?
Yep, it's just the venom. So we're not mixing it with anything. We just get the venom out, then we separate it. And then what I would then do would be to test the venom. So I usually inject it into crickets and then see if there's any effect or no effect. If the cricket has died, then you know it's been effective. If not, you separate it again based on a different technique, test them again until you reach to the single one peptide that's causing the effect. Because you start off with hundreds,
right,
and you need to narrow it down to one.
Why do other insects respond so strongly to this ant venom? Is it quite potent?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. That particular one, the Ponrata paraponera clavata, which is the bullet ant, is very potent. And what we're trying to find is, are the others as potent as this one? Are they as potent as spiders, which are super potent? And that's what we're trying to figure out.
If we're using this venom to attack insects that are attacking crops per se, would that have an implication for humans that we might be affected by that same venom?
So that's one of the testing steps that needs to be done. So with all insecticides and other therapeutics, they need to be tested on mammals and on human cells, and then obviously on humans as well. Most of the time there won't be an effect on humans, especially with the case of ants. They're not seen to be dangerous to humans unless you're allergic. So the fact that it might be affecting humans is low, especially the fact that insects usually are very specific to their prey. So I know some ants which will only be insecticidal to a certain termite. So one of mine was super complex, it had so many things, tested it on the crickets, nothing happened to the cricket. When you look into, did some research on it, I found that it only preys on termites. So although it had so many components in the venom, none of it was working on crickets, which was our target organism.
I guess that makes sense. You would have an ant that would evolve to have a certain predator, and its venom would only apply to a termite.
Yeah, that's how it works. So that's what we would really like, is to have a venom that's only targeting agricultural pests and not affecting bees, for example, which is one of the major problems right now. So if it could be specific for Lepidopterans, for example, that would be great. Just a class of insects. They're usually one of the ones that affect crops. Then it would be great for it not to affect bees.
How do you find it researching into this area of, you know, naturally derived insecticides compared to the abundance of synthetic ones available on the market, which I guess historically have been used out of convenience and perhaps because they are cheaper?
Obviously, this is a growing field because the current supply, it's decreasing more so because of resistance by the insects. So they're not becoming effective at all. So you might have found it yourself if you're home trying to spray a cockroach and it's not really working because that insecticide is no longer effective. Cockroaches have been able to develop resistance to them, along with the fact that most of them are harmful to human health and to the environment and to especially to animals as well. So going to the natural side is, I feel like, the best option for us, because there's also the fact that the current problem with it is that a lot of pharmaceutical companies aren't really agreeing to develop this or fund these types of projects because there is the belief or the stigma that it's not going to be as tolerated by the insect, or it's not going to be as effective because they are peptides, they might not be absorbed properly. So there's still stuff to be done before we can develop them fully.
And that was Samir Ali, PhD candidate from the University of Technology, Sydney.
2SAR, live and streaming at 2SAR.com.
Mental Health Awareness Week in the UK has sparked conversations internationally about the lack of availability and effective treatment of complex mental illness, specifically in the areas of eating disorders. 2SAR's The Daily was joined by Richard Newton, board member of the Butterfly Foundation for Eating Disorders Online.
So to start off with, historically there are a lot of misconceptions associated with the types of individuals who will get eating disorders. Could you set the record straight for us on perhaps who is affected by eating disorders?
I think the truth is that eating disorders reach into all areas of society and our community. They're seen around the world in every culture that we look at, not just first world cultures. And they've been present since, kind of the earliest recordings of history. So we tend to think of the eating disorders as diseases that have arisen as a result of the specific that's not the case. And in fact, what we're seeing more and more of now is more men, more older people, and indeed also, quite tragically, more very young children presenting with eating disorders.
Do we have any explanation for perhaps this rise in children suffering from eating disorders?
So it's hard to explain fully, and there's a number of possible explanations. Almost all of them, I think, are to do with an understanding of weight concerns and body image concerns that are entrenched in, certainly are entrenched in Western society. And so although eating disorders are seen in all cultures, there's no question that they're more common in women than men. And they're more common in groups in our society that have strong views about unattainable body images. So we see eating disorders increased in frequency in models, in people who work in industries where weight loss and high focus on body image is common, such as ballet dancers and athletes, etc.
And what are some of the recommended methods of treatment for someone who does have an eating disorder?
So I think this is one of the really important parts of the message that we're trying to get across through Butterfly's May Day campaign. That although eating disorders are serious, or for example, anorexia nervosa has the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorder that we know of, these disorders are able to be effectively treated in children. We can treat them very effectively with a therapy called family-based treatment. And in adults, there's a treatment called cognitive behavior therapy that has been specifically modified to be effective in people with anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder, which are the main eating disorders that we're trying to ensure get adequate treatment. Unfortunately, as you've been reading and as you alluded to, Tess, the issue is that Medicare provides for 10 visits to an allied health professional, for example, a psychologist, to provide treatment in any one year. And yet we know that the minimum amount of treatment that is effective in eating disorder, in any of those eating disorders, is 20 sessions of treatment. And so at the moment, the great concern is that through Medicare, we are systematically underdosing people in terms of the amount of treatment that they can receive for their eating disorder. And we know that low quality treatment, such as underdose treatment, is ineffective. And what we know is that effective treatment leads to good outcomes and actually reduces the cost of treatment in the long run, because if somebody has an eating disorder for a very long period of time, then the type of treatment that they're going to respond to is going to be much more complex and much more lengthy.
It's some staggering numbers that you've just mentioned there. What can be done, or what would you like to see be done to make treatment more widely accessible?
So there's the structural issue with the Medicare, which I think is a really important thing to address, because it says something to me about our society and its attitude towards mental health. We would not tolerate this kind of underdosing in physical illnesses such as heart disease. We know about the scandals and the huge concern that's been raised about underdosing in cancer recently. We shouldn't accept this society in mental illness. That deserves the same level of treatment and the same commitment to the treatment as other illnesses do. But another part of accessing good treatment for eating disorders is to recognise that there is a significant gap in the understanding, skills and training of healthcare professionals in eating disorders. And if you listen to family members and people with eating disorders, they describe enormous difficulties in identifying a healthcare professional who has the level of skills and competency to provide them with good care. They often describe years of rejection, misunderstandings, incomplete treatments because of around training on eating disorders. And I think that's something else that needs to be addressed in order to make these treatments accessible. Healthcare professionals need to understand what eating disorders are, how to diagnose them, how to recognise them, and what to do once they've recognised them. And there's a gap there as well.
And that was Richard Newton, board member of the Butterfly Foundation for Eating Disorders, on The Daily.
2SER 107.3 FM and now digital.
It's commonly known that eating fast food can cause health problems, which in turn could cause heart disease. But a growing body of evidence is suggesting that fast food can also adversely affect the capacity of your lungs. Matthew Wright spoke with Professor Lisa Wood from the Priority Research Centre for Healthy Lungs at the University of Newcastle.
It seems that most of the studies investigating the link between diet and lung health focus on chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. Can you explain what this is?
So COPD is a disease where the lungs gradually decline over time. So the cause is most often smoking, but other exposures can also lead to COPD. So things like occupational exposure and air pollution, these can also lead to COPD. And as each year goes by, the lungs progressively decline, and of course that makes breathing very difficult and has very significant impacts on lifestyle.
Can you walk us through some of the evidence suggesting that eating more fruit and vegetables is good for your lungs? And I guess in particular, you've just done a study regarding asthma?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's lots of reasons why we should be eating fruits and vegetables. And I think people understand that fruits and vegetables are helpful for losing weight or maintaining weight. And there's also lots of evidence to say that they're protective in diseases like, you know, cardiovascular disease and diabetes. But the evidence around respiratory health is more recent. And over time, it's been described that most of the evidence in COPD, it comes from big population studies, epidemiological studies, which is where people look at patterns of eating and then how that affects disease risk. And over the years, there's been a number of studies now that have shown in these large studies that fruit and vegetables appear to be protective against COPD risk. The strongest level of evidence that we can get is when we actually intervene with people and we take people with a disease and we see how it modifies the disease outcomes. And I think that's the study that you refer to. We recently did a study in asthmatics where we did just that. So actually, when I say recently, it's about 5 years ago. Time moves quickly. But what we did, we got people to either consume the recommended intake of fruit and vegetables, which is 5 serves of vegetables and 2 serves of fruit per day, or the what is actually the typical Australian diet, which is less than 3 serves per day. And we saw that when we did that in people with asthma, another type of respiratory disease, that reduced their risk of having an asthma attack. So this is really exciting data because it suggests that this is an approach which could be used in addition to your traditional medications to improve asthma outcomes.
So what are the physical mechanisms which allow fruit and vegetables to give us healthier lungs?
Well, for a long time we've known that they were rich in antioxidants, so things like vitamin C, beta-carotene, lycopene. And those antioxidants are helpful in a disease where you have production of excess free radicals. So just to go back a step, in both COPD and in asthma, the cells in the airways are overactive and they produce a lot of these free radicals, which are chemicals that move into the bloodstream and can cause damage. And antioxidants, we know, can mop up those free radicals and stop them from doing damage. So that's one approach, or one angle that we know is important. The other thing that's become more recently described is the effect of dietary fibre. And that surprises a lot of people because often you think of fibre as something that you need to have to keep you regular, which is true. But some types of fibre actually don't just pass through the gut to be used for production of waste. Some types of fibre, once they reach the bowel, the bacteria in the bowel digests that fibre and causes production of these short-chain fatty acids. And more evidence is showing us that those short-chain fatty acids are actually protective. They interact with immune cells and stop the inflammation that causes a lot of these diseases that we're talking about.
So it seems like there's a variety of mechanisms which these fruit and vegetables can help to stop lung cancer. And I guess that you have quite simple advice that we need to eat more fruit and veg. That's kind of the main thrust of the article that you've just written.
Yeah, so people, as I mentioned, that have understood the beneficial effects of fruit and vegetables for a long time, but this evidence to show that they're actually helpful in respiratory disease is relatively new. And even though it's very simple advice, most people don't adhere to it. And so I think that reminding people of the type of benefits or the type of protection that can be gained by eating in this way is really important. We need to keep telling people there's a reason why we recommend five serves and two serves of fruit per day. There's a reason for that. It's protective against disease, and I think it's really important to just keep that at the forefront of people's minds.
That was Matthew Wright speaking with Professor Lisa Wood from the Priority Research Centre for Healthy Lungs at the University of Newcastle. Two US families, the Hendersons and the Gassmans, are being interviewed here by the BBC on why they chose embryo adoption.
At the end of our in vitro cycles, we had 11 embryos that were left over, and we tried to figure out what was the right path for us. There's really only about three or four choices that it comes down to. You can either choose to destroy them, you can donate them to science, you can keep them frozen, or you can donate them to another family. For us, we wanted to see those embryos be given a chance at life. And that's, I think that's really what it came down to.
Now, I know you're both committed Christians, aren't you? How much of a part did your faith play in that decision, Rebecca?
It played a tremendous role. Like I said, we believe that life begins at conception. As far as we were concerned, there was no ability for me to carry any more children. And we wanted, more than anything, to give them a chance at life. Even beyond that, because although there are anonymous donor programs that we could have given to, we wanted to not only give them a chance at life, but have some hand in deciding who those children go to and having some knowledge of who they are and what becomes of them.
This is where I suppose some people will question all this and wonder how you matched your embryos to Kelly and Dan. So let's meet Kelly and Dan. Kelly, tell me a little bit about how long it took you to come to the decision where you would think about receiving donated embryos.
My husband and I married older. I was 42 when we got married, and then about a year after that, we started trying to conceive, and after about 18 months of not being able to get pregnant, we sought an infertility specialist, and it was at that point the infertility specialist said, Kelly, your eggs are no longer viable. And so I was talking to our family physician who told me about embryo adoption. After going home and researching it with Dan, we knew immediately that that was what we wanted to do. And that next Monday, we started calling programs, and it was at that point we were on to our next step. So we didn't have that same long timeline because,
no,
of course...
you felt that you had to get on with it, to be blunt,
yes,
about it.
Time was not on my side.
No. Dan, you didn't think about adoption? That wasn't what you wanted?
For me, this traditional adoption wasn't really the direction I wanted to go.
You could, of course, have chosen sperm donation or egg donation, Kelly, and that would have meant that there would have been in the child one of your genetic components, if you like. Did you not think of that?
Well, cost was a huge factor in choosing not to go with anonymous egg donation. Here in the U.S., anonymous egg donation would have cost upwards of $40,000, which was very cost prohibitive. And I think Dan and I both decided we wanted it to either be both of us or neither of us.
Well, a lot of people, I think, will understand that. And the cost, can I ask how much this way cost you?
It was probably around $20,000, and that was not for each child. That was just for the first time.
For the whole thing. So in pure economic terms, it was half the price. So can I go back to you, Rebecca? Did you meet Kelly and Dan, and how did all that come about, and how did it go?
Well, we were very fortunate in the fact that although in our contract between the Gosmans and us, we did set up a minimum set of standards of communication, but we indicated that we were open to more. And we were so blessed that the Gosmans were also open to more and were willing to contact us directly and say, hey, we really want to have direct communication with you. We'd like to meet you.
Chris, how does the matching process take place?
So we went through a fairly extensive matching criteria. We filled out a bunch of paperwork that provided a lot of medical backgrounds, medical histories, family histories. We went through an agency out in California who took all that information and matched us with Dan and Kelly.
It's kind of like the eHarmony, but for embryos.
Yes. Okay.
You go through just all kinds of things. What kind of spiritual background is that important to you? How important is education to you? How important is the number of years that they've been married? How financially stable? Is it important that one parent work and the other one stay home? Or is it okay if they both work? And then they match you up with those people that fit within that same criteria.
And Kelly, how long did you have to wait for all this to take place?
Once we finished the paperwork phase, literally we were matched within about 6 weeks.
And can I ask all four of you, you were all keen on being open. Kelly, is that right?
Oh, yes, very much so. We wanted some level of openness. I don't think we initially thought when we started that we would have the level of openness that we have today, but it's been the most incredible blessing ever.
Well, yeah, well, I'm interested in that. Dan, I mean, how often do you speak to Rebecca and Chris?
Probably speak to them probably once every few months. Kelly and Becky, they keep touch through all kinds of things, Facebook and sure. Email and text and talk on the phone.
Kelly, how old are your children now?
Our son is just turned 4.5 and our daughter is 3.
And how much will they know about all this in the future?
They actually already know. We started telling them about being baby seeds and how the doctor transferred them to mommy and that they were gifts to us from the Hendersons. And they understand the concept that they have 3 sisters in the Henderson family. And they've also met Chris and Becky and their sisters. So it's a very normal thing. It's just a natural part of their growing up experience.
And Chris and Becky, or either of you, can I ask how your children react to all this and what they say?
Oh, certainly. We started while Kelly was pregnant. We had, again, just begun our open communication. So she had been sending me pictures, sonogram pictures, pictures of her pregnant or during a baby shower. And so I had started collecting those and putting together a scrapbook. Because I knew down the line we were going to be very open with our children about any of the embryos that did become babies. About the time that our genetic son was 2 months old,
yeah,
we started sharing with our girls about him, who he was, how he came about.
Right.
Started sharing our story and showed them the scrapbook. And we've just continued that scrapbook as our genetic daughter has come along, as each of them have grown. We just add to it. And again, just like Kelly said, it's our normal.
But I noticed that you used the term our genetic son.
Yes.
Is that a term you're all happy with? Because obviously I'm sure that Kelly and Dan regard the little boy as their son.
I think we haven't referred to the children that Chris and Becky are their genetic parents, because at this point, where they are developmentally would be confusing.
Yeah.
But that's really who they are. Dan and I are their parents, but they do have genetic parents as well.
That report, Care of the BBC, on the Hendersons and the Gasmans on why they chose embryo adoption. And that music means we're out of time. You've been listening to Panacea on 2SER 107.3. I'm Quentin Strawley. Let's make it a date next week, 7 o'clock next Tuesday. Have a great week.